Gems have their own stories, but it is the journey through the hands of humans where the stories start, continue, and will continue. And we are just, humans are just custodians of these minerals that the earth provides.
SSCF presents the Hidden Gem podcast, conversations with the world's leading people behind the journey of gems and jewels, from the source to the finished piece. Today on Hidden Gems, I'm speaking with Joanna Hardy, one of Britain's best-known jewellery experts and a familiar face from the BBC's Antiques Roadshow. We met in London at Goldsmiths Hall during Goldsmiths Fair. Joanna trained as a goldsmith and began her career in diamonds, but her true passion lies in coloured gemstones, rubies, sapphires, emeralds, and the remarkable stories they carry across cultures and generations. In this episode, we talk about curiosity, craft, trust in the trade, and why for Joanna, understanding a gemstone means going all the way back to its source. Joanna Hardy, you're one of Britain's best-known jewellery experts. BBC Antiques Roadshow, for example. You trained as a goldsmith, you worked as a rough diamond valuer for De Beers, and later you were a senior specialist at auction houses. And today you run an independent consultancy and you teach and publish widely. Now, you've written incredible books and lectures all over the world, Joanna. Why is it that storytelling is so important in gems and fine jewellery?
Well, I think it is, first of all, it's very nice to see you, Laurent. Thank you for inviting me to talk.
And we are here in the Goldsmiths Hall.
And we are here in the Goldsmiths Hall, which is in the City of London, by St Paul's Cathedral. It's like my second home at the moment, as I'm third warden of the Goldsmiths Company. So going to your question, well, gems and people, you know, you've got to have the gems and the people. The two are interlinked. So, you know, gems have their own stories, but it is the journey through the hands of humans where the stories start, continue, and will continue. And we are just, humans are just custodians of these minerals that the earth provides. Which, in fact, I was reading the other day that diamonds, correct me if I'm wrong, can be formed in space, but wood can't. You know, and so suddenly, you know, pearls, I don't think, can be formed in space. Not yet. We haven't found any. Or have we found pearls in space?
Not that I know of yet. I mean, but in vitro pearls may come in the very near future. So I don't want to exclude any.
No, but I think we still don't fully appreciate the marvels of these materials that the earth provides. And there is that fascination. And I've always been fascinated. And I've been, it's fascinating to see how people react to them too, good and bad.
And in very different ways, I imagine.
Oh, gosh. I mean, yes. Vanity and greed, and gemstones and metals seem to go a bit hand in hand. But, you know, it's not all about the money. Mm. And I think we must discount that, because that side is very much a modern thinking behind gemstones and, you know, materials like that, because they weren't sort of money-fied.
And that's one of the reasons, actually, for doing this podcast series and speaking to all these different people, is that to go beyond that money, is that there is passion, there is enthusiasm. You've been interested in gems and jewellery for many decades. What got you into this, or what keeps you kind of motivated and curious and still looking at different gems?
I think, well, I have an awful lot to thank the industry for and gemstones for, because when I was a young kid, my godmother was the first woman to pass her FGA with distinction in 1932, and she was Margaret Biggs, and she and her sister, they were two spinsters that lived in a Georgian house in Farnham in Surrey. And they had a jewellery shop, Biggs of Farnham. And in fact, there was also Biggs of Maidenhead. And she was my godmother. She was quite a bit older. I mean, she was almost like a mother to my father. But I remember going there for afternoon tea sometimes with my parents. And she was quite a formidable lady, but very, very kind. And my parents held her in very high regard. in terms of her integrity. And she always was very smartly dressed, and she always had big gold bracelets and big gold chains. And she had in her drawing room at home these wonderful Georgian glass vitrines full of minerals, just all the sort of like a cabinet of curiosity, but beautifully clean, you know, and it wasn't higgledy-piggledy. And her sister Mary used to paint those minerals like abstract paintings. So she was almost sort of ahead of her time in terms of, it's rather like, you know, we looking through a microscope at inclusions in gemstones and you can see abstract work. She did that with oil paintings. And so you had these vibrant oil paintings around this Georgian house of minerals. And then you had the specimens in the cabinets, in these Georgian cabinets. And for a young girl, I mean, that was just mesmerising. But I didn't really understand what was going on. But I think it was osmosis that was that possibly sowed a seed without me knowing. So that was my sort of first introduction to that. And I suppose, you know, as a child, like most children, you know, if you're on the beach or in the woods, you like picking up small things. And I remember having at home a lot of, I don't know, little children's science kits where you'd have these sort of very rudimentary microscopes where you can put your acorn underneath or something and look at it. And when I went to Beedales, which is a school in Petersfield in Hampshire, which very much focused on the craft, and the craft was seen as the same importance as sciences and music. So at 14, we had jewellery classes.
Wow.
So I just thought, well, this is, you know, I just felt like the school was like a holiday. So I started to make jewellery when I was 14. Mm. And I loved it, and I absolutely loved it. And, of course, it was, we were using all kinds of materials. I mean, from 14 to 16 to 17, yeah, that's what I continued doing. And rather than being in a chemistry lab, at the time, I would spend my time in the workshops. And I've still got those pieces that I made out of, you know, perspex and gilding metal. And there was some silver and acrylic, and it was very abstract. In fact, when I look back, I think, oh, that was quite imaginative for a 15, 16-year-old, because I didn't know much about the world of jewellery at all. Mm. So it was coming from a young person's imagination, really. And had a great teacher. It's always about the teachers, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, I wasn't focusing on what I probably should be doing academically, but he allowed, you know, the school allowed the opportunity to work weekends there because it was a boarding school. So I would work weekends there and in the workshop making, creating jewellery.
Wow, and here you are many, many years later, yes. Goldsmiths Hall, it's Goldsmiths Fair in London,
yes.
And we've got emerging, young, new designers or established designers that are being exhibited here, and you are supporting the future of the British kind of jewellery scene, so...
Yes, it's sort of...
Who would have thought?
Dare I say? Who would have thought? I think the teacher at the time said, what are we going to do with Joey? And because I was a bit sort of, you know, didn't follow normal procedures in school. And so when I, you know, when I came up to Sir John Cass College, I did a foundation course at Farnham and then I went to Sir John Cass College. But then the kind of the creativity went out the window because it was all about making bar brooches and claw settings and obviously learning the trade. And I just... I wasn't very good at it, quite honestly, but it was fantastic to understand the complexities and the skill needed to make a good quality piece of jewellery, which has held me in good stead for either valuing or for when, you know, now, as you say, we're here at the Goldsmiths Company and the hall, and we've got over 2 weeks, like 170 silversmiths and goldsmiths, all who have made their own pieces, designed and made their pieces. And I have that complete sort of understanding and synergy with them because I know what it's like and really appreciate the creativity and being able to express yourself. To be able to express yourself with any form of art, I think, is wonderful. And I do sort of miss that. I would like to have... Well, I wasn't any good at it, but I appreciate the value in it.
Do you still have a bench at home?
No. That's long gone. No.
And did you ever think of getting into, or have you tried cutting gemstones as well, given that you had face?
Or? I haven't done that. I think because then, I then was working in Hatton Garden as a Saturday girl while I was at Sir John Cass College and selling sort of rubbish, I'm afraid. It was just, it was gold chains with a bolt ring on the end and that was about it. But there was Holt's across the road. And Mr. Holt, I remember going into that shop in my lunch break and just going through all these... He would just let me rummage through all these stones and I maybe might be able to afford an amethyst for 5p or something. In fact, I've got the stone collection that I started to collect. I've still got it when I was... Well, I was about 17, 18 years old. Couldn't afford anything at all, but just a tiny bit of fragment of coral or something was just so exciting. But I left school with very few qualifications. So, if any, well, no, I had a couple. that's when I just thought, when I went into Mr. Holt's shop, I just thought, my goodness, I'd love to learn more about this. And that was the gemology side.
So how did you end up then afterwards with De Beers and then the auction houses?
Well, so I did my gemology in the evenings at Aldgate East. And then what did I do? Oh, yes, well, I left college and then I worked full-time in Hatton Garden. And I was walking down Leather Lane, the fruit and veg market, which was a fruit and veg market at the time. This was in the 80s. And I just thought there's got to be more than just selling gold chains in Hatton Garden. And somebody, I was talking to somebody in down Leather Lane and they said, well, De Beers are looking for people. And I'd never heard of De Beers. I was, well, who are they? And they said, well, it's the mining company. Of course, there weren't any shops or anything like they are now. I had just finished my diamond diploma. So I went along, applied at the CSO to be a valuer and sorter for De Beers in Charterhouse Street in the 80s. And gosh, that was quite a thing. I didn't know what I was getting into at all. But it was, but anyway, I sort of got the job. And then it was a bit of a learning curve, a bit of a disappointment, a bit of a shocking thing in that, suddenly I was in the bought department. I just thought, I'd learned all about these gems in my gemology and now I'm sitting in front of piles of bought and near gem. And I just thought, oh my goodness. But they train you for about 6 months beforehand.
So you were sorting quality and then preparing parcels for site holders who would then bid on?
Yes, yeah. So it was very much, the 12,000 categories or whatever there was in rough diamonds. So you did have a training. And the training was good because you had to make sure that you didn't get eye strain. So you had those, visors that you would put down, whatever, the magnifying visors. And the desks were very high, so that made you sit up so that you didn't slouch because you were really a factory. You were just going, white one, brown one, well, not quite like that, but almost like that. And they also showed you their new super-duper security cameras. I remember that. I remember going down into the security and they just showed you what they can see. So if you had any thoughts of doing anything, they would see first. But it was still pretty advanced stuff. It was amazing. And there were no corners on each of the floors. Everything was curved. So if you dropped a crystal, it wouldn't get stuck in a corner. So all these things It was an incredible time because it was like Big Brother. I mean, you didn't have to buy your chicken for Christmas. They'd give you one of those or a capon. All the staff would be queuing around the building before Christmas to get your turkey or a capon, depending on how long you had been there. If you were a senior, you got a turkey, and if you were a junior, you got a capon.
Wow. These were the old days where they still dominated quite a large share of the international diamond market and trade. Yeah,
we weren't allowed to go to America because it was a monopoly that they had at the time, which if you were in America, it was a criminal offence, but it wasn't over in the UK. And you had amazing insurance. You had amazing... you had boxes at Covent Garden, Royal Opera House, and no one went to them. So myself and a girlfriend who, at the time, who also worked at De Beers, we went to all these amazing shows at the Albert Hall and Covent Garden in these boxes.
Wow.
It was just... And I think we had to pay like £2 or something for a ticket. So we went and saw everything in London. It was amazing. You could live and breathe De Beers. You didn't need to go anywhere else.
Did you get to travel, or all the goods just came to London?
No, you see, this is what I thought. I thought, oh, I can go off to Africa in my khaki outfit. You know, I just thought, because that really appealed. Well, I was so far from that. I mean, I was a woman to start with, so I wasn't getting anywhere as a woman.
Well, you did that later on, then going to Zambia and Mozambique.
Much later.
Yes, so,
it's like 40 years later. But at the time, so that's why I wanted to go to, I wanted to go to Africa. I wanted to, go on adventures, but that clearly wasn't going to happen at De Beers. And so when I saw in the retail jeweller an advert to be an assistant polished diamond dealer in Antwerp, I thought, well, I'll apply. I got the job. I don't know. I mean, it was with J.C. Jinder. And I was like 22, 23, I think now. And he was very clever, in fact, to hire me because, I mean, I'm not Jewish and I was a young girl. And he was a diamond merchant, meaning then that they would buy from site holders that through brokers and with, polished goods. And you'd be selling to wholesalers. Then the wholesalers would make the jewellery and sell to retailers. So there was a very methodical line of track of business, not like now. It was completely, completely changed. But I think because I had worked for De Beers, he thought, well, she's been in the diamond world. Mm. That's a great sort of name to have behind you. And so I got the job. And so I went in my Ford Fiesta with my futon that I had bought, and I drove over to Antwerp and found this flat in Provinciestraat by the zoo. And that was, I remember thinking, oh my goodness, I knew absolutely no one. Went into the office, I was the assistant to Nico van Gent, who had been running the Antwerp office for years and years. And the first day he showed me a parcel of diamonds, melee or something, and he told me to sort them into various categories. I had absolutely no clue what he was talking about, and he went off and he came back 20 minutes later and he said, have they sent me someone that doesn't know anything? And I just went, yes, I don't. And he said, well, you're here now, I better train you. So he trained me, but you see, what was interesting was that, so my patch was Scandinavia and London, and I got commission. So I had a basic pay, but I had commission. And if ever there was an incentive, that was an incentive for me. And I only lived in Antwerp for a year, but I would travel with Henry Jinder to Ramekgan 3 times a year. We're buying in the Schupstraat, we had our offices, so the brokers would come to us. But I very soon realised that, sometimes they would be shouting down the phone when we'd given a bad offer, and you know, there would be no one on the other end of the phone anyway. It was all big game and a big...
So it was a very male world as well, very masculine world.
Very, very masculine. I mean, when I walked out on the street and I would, at first I'd say hello to the brokers, they'd just almost ignore me. And offices in Israel, in Ramat Gan, there were some I couldn't walk into. So it was, it was a very, very male world. And the people that I was selling to were all male. I didn't meet any women at all. The only women I'd meet, if brokers, you know, they had died and their widows would take over the business. But that would be the only time and that I would meet another woman in the business. So it was very tough. But Henry Jinder, I think he thought, well, how am I going to get my goods in front of buyers when there's a whole line of guys, you know, Orthodox Jews and, you know, just all sitting there? So he thought, I'll have a young girl. And it worked because I would be asked into an office first, I think from an entertainment point of view, as far as they were concerned. They just thought, well, she knows nothing. It's just, what is she doing here? And, of course, there's no mobile phones, there's, you know, nothing like that. And they were very rude most of the time. And I just thought, it was all survival. You know, I'd left home at 16 and I just, this was my job and I'm going to be good at my job. And I just knew that through knowledge, that in the end, knowledge was power.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the end, those same people that were rude to me gave me the best business ever. Because also I was so diligent in, you know, they'd ask for, I don't know, 10 carats or 4 per carat or whatever. And I would measure the tables. I mean, I would literally, you wouldn't have any fish eyes in any of it. You would, you know, I would make sure that if the stones were matching, you know, they were matching. They wanted 10 pointers, I would 2.95 to 3.01. You know, I would absolutely measure the diameters, I'd measure the tables. And so they liked that because I went that extra bit.
So is that a I'm sure you get that question often from students or people who are looking at young people who are trying to get into the trade or getting into gemology, is just try and get as much as experience as you can and be as diligent as you can. And just, I mean, this is a great example of how you were curious and you tried to collect all these different kinds of experience to bring your career to where it is now.
Yes, I think that's, I mean, I'm just a curious person. Hmm. So I wasn't happy. You know, I'm not happy to write a book on sapphires without going to see where sapphires come from and emeralds and rubies, everything like that. But also I want to see what really is going on. You know, I don't want to hear from other people. I want to see it for myself. I love travelling. I don't mind roughing it. I love camping. You know, I ride motorbikes. It's so, for me, that's a privilege to be able to go off to countries where most people wouldn't go to, A, and B, see what I see and the people I meet, you know, because it's certainly off the beaten track and off the tourist track, and that I love.
Mm.
You know, I feel very lucky to have done that. So I do say to people, they always say, what to get into the trade, you know, well, there's so many different aspects of the trade, and then I feel it's not until you've worked in all very aspects, A, do you know which bit you like and which bit you don't like. Mm. And that takes time to understand it. You know, the auction world, oh my goodness, that was a whole other world.
So you came back to London then to work for auction
houses?
So
that was, yes, after Antwerp. And then I came back and I was back in the office, the Jinder office in London. But I will tell you one story. So it was Garrard's, and they owned Mappin & Webb at the time as well. And the guy that was the buyer for them put a tender out to, you know, he was going to buy diamonds to fill all these 3 stone rings, 5 stone rings, ear studs. I mean, it was a huge order. It's a massive order for the whole of Mappin & Webb. And this time, you know, this guy who had been rude to me originally, but now wasn't, and we had a good working relationship, and he said, well, I'll give you this order. The order was enormous. Absolutely enormous. And I thought, oh my goodness. I remember rushing back to Henry Jinder. I said, look at this. This is the order that we've got. And he went, right. I mean, but there was no upfront money. We had to fund it. I mean, it was a lot of money. So Henry got very much involved. And of course, he only wanted, you know, 10 mils, 10 pointers. He would only want sort of 3 millimetres and absolutely exact. So you're also having a big order, but you're having to parcel pick. And then, you know, to parcel pick and get a competitive price per carat was very, very difficult, almost impossible, because everyone wants those, you know, they don't want...
So parcel pick means that you're just selecting the best stones out of parcels.
So you select out of the best stones, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you'd have parcels and say you've got, you know, 20 carats of melee, and then you'd say, well, OK, I'll buy this, but I'll have a 50% rejection. And you would do the rejection and then parcel it up and wrap it up and sign it and seal it and see if... And say, well, I'll only pay this price and I'll only pay so many days. And, you know, there was all that going on. So we were doing that with all different sizes, and we were going from Antwerp, we were going to Israel. And it took about 6 months to get this order together. And I used to always just go on the tube, but I lashed out and went by cab this time, because I had the whole entire order in this briefcase. All I had measured all the tables, all the diameters of the stones, everything was a VS1FG. And I remember going up to... This was when Garrard were on the corner of Regent Street. And it had a telephone box outside the entrance. If I'd go, the tradesman, of course, would go the back entrance. And I went up to see the guy. And I just put this briefcase down on the table. And I just sat down. And then he just turned the briefcase round. He opened it, just grabbed one Briefke out of it, diamond paper out of it, where I had put the pairs of stones. And he looped two diamonds. Then he put that back, got another Briefke. And there was hundreds of Briefkes in there. So, I mean, he just sort of like randomly just picked out two Briefkes and looked at the stones through his loop. And then he put them back. He shut the suitcase, locked it, and he said, invoice the lot. Oh, my goodness. I can't tell you. That was just amazing. It was better than winning the lottery, because I had put so much time and effort into it too, and Henry Jinder had too. And yet we had the biggest deal ever. And I just thought, you know, it was this guy at the very beginning, a few years ago, had been really dismissive of me, had given me the best order, and it was just brilliant.
So how important are trust and integrity in this trade?
Oh, it's huge.
It's incredible,
yeah,
right?
It's
compared
huge.
To other businesses.
Absolutely.
Or industries, and it's been around for centuries.
Yeah.
It still fascinates me today.
No money had been exchanged. No, you know, no invoice. I hadn't given him an invoice. I hadn't given him anything.
So he didn't even know what it would cost him?
No, well, roughly, but I mean, I hadn't produced the invoice because I didn't know if he wanted them. Goodness knows what we would have done if he'd said, oh, I don't like this, or he starts picking at it. And so that's what I just really wanted to make sure, that he didn't start picking out things, saying, well, that's good, that's not good. I didn't want him to find a fault, and he didn't find a fault. And it was for the whole chain of Mappin & Webb. I mean, it was just... And the commission that I got, well, I was just... I think I paid for some horse riding in Hyde Park. I said, oh, that's... Because it was quite expensive, horse riding in Hyde Park. And I went to New York as well, because I just thought, oh, this is... That was amazing. That was a great lesson as well. And I've got so much to thank the guy at Garrard at the time, you know, even now to this day. He showed me what, you know, hard work... And it wasn't about male or female. It was just being good at your job. Mm. And that's what people want at the end of the day.
Yeah.
They want your trust, they want your honesty, reputation, and be good.
And it takes years to build that up.
Yeah. And it takes years to build it up, exactly. Mm. So he had given me the impetus to carry on, you know, because I was still very young in my career. I mean, you know, I'd have absolutely no idea what I would be doing next month, let alone, you know, where I'm sitting now. You know, it didn't even occur to me where my career was going to go or take me. And it was then that, and then after, you know, afterwards, someone phoned me up and said, Phillips, the auctioneers, which are now Bonhams, so they were looking for a diamond expert at the time. I don't like the word expert, specialist. And I remember thinking, auction? What is auction? And I thought, antique jewellery? I went, oh my goodness, I know absolutely nothing about antique jewellery. And as for coloured gemstones, I hadn't seen a sapphire or anything with colour since I did my gemology, because I'd been in the diamond, you know, rough and polished for a good 5 years. So I just thought, wow. So I remember I was still living in Antwerp, and I would go before the interview to Phillips. I just thought, well, I better go to the V&A and the British Museum, to the jewellery galleries. And I remember sitting there weekends trying to work out what all these styles and periods were called, because I'd had absolutely no art training at all. So I hadn't got a clue about Art Nouveau or any of this. I had no idea.
And now you're on the BBC on, what, a weekly or a monthly basis, Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah.
And people show you a piece, and you not only need to identify it, you also need to put a value on it.
Yes, and know that it's real and it's true.
How is that? How is it engaging with the trade compared to engaging with
the public? I think that was, yeah, that's a good question, because having been with the trade and all the diamond dealers at the time who were buying from auction, because at that time in the 80s, everyone was recutting old cuts. So you had a few of the diamond guys with their microscopes, and they would come with their microscopes when they were viewing the sale, the auctions. And all they were going to do were pop out the big stones and recut them into modern brilliance. But because they knew that I had spent, a number of years grading polished and rough, so I was inundated with dealers wanting my grades on, they were just phoning me and giving me a list and just say, what are your thoughts on these stones? So that's what I did. So I was very comfortable with them because I was used to dealers, that's all who I had worked with. So general public, oh my goodness, that was a whole nother world, because suddenly I realised that it was 70% counselling and 30% knowledge.
So the expectations of people that they had...
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, you're dealing with emotions. I wasn't really dealing with people's emotions, other than you got a deal, didn't get a deal. I mean, that's about it of the emotions. But when you suddenly, my mother's left me this, and my husband's done that, and oh my gosh, it blew me away. I just thought they've got an estimate of 3,000 to 5,000. I mean, like, and it doesn't sell. I just thought, what is this business, And you put a low reserve on it, and I thought, no one's putting their money where their mouth is. And I just thought, that makes it a bit easy, And I thought it was a bizarre world. And then finding out that people had, really wanted... I'd never heard of Sotheby's or Christie's. I had no idea who these people were, or these firms were. And people went to art school and universities and had art history degrees, because they wanted to work in auction houses. It was just a complete different world. But Phillips, working for Phillips, which was great, because it was a great learning curve, and it wasn't too scary a place, so you could cut your teeth on it. And it was a very fun place, In fact, people on the Antiques Roadshow... Now, I've been doing the Antiques Roadshow for 20 years now, and I'm working with people that I worked with back in those days. And this is like, we're nearly talking 40 years ago, 35 years ago at Phillips. So there was a huge camaraderie has grown from that as well. As well as I still... Some of the diamond dealers, I still work with them, or they phone me up out of the blue and there's that instant connection. And that's the same with Phillips. It was great. Phillips was great.
And it's changed so much over the years, hasn't it? Because this was a period of time with no mobile phones. People weren't taking 360-degree videos of diamonds to figure out, this or that, how can it be recut. it was so different. How do you see this evolution? Of now, you know, people are WhatsApping videos of million-dollar stones.
Yeah. Gosh, it's changed. It's changed. It's changed so much. I think what really has changed is that, you know, your world was quite small. It didn't matter where you travelled, you'd bump into the same people. And that still is today, but with the internet and with the amount of people that are talking about, you know, I don't know, influences and trends and goodness knows, you know, all of that stuff, you've lost that person, you know, that sort of closeness, that kind of one-to-one with someone, that kind of relationship that you've built up over the years. Now everything seems so transient. And with that, I think it's very difficult for people in that sense. But I think relationships are even more important today because, you know, there's so many pitfalls if you don't know who you're dealing with.
Well, and we talked about this before, this element of trust is so important. Mm. And it's going to continue to be important because there's also so much money involved. And that is a human-to-human connection in the end.
Yes.
You can go as virtual as you want on these things, but in the end, that's kind of what this business is about, so...
Yeah, no, it is. And it's yes, I mean, you know, the relationships. I mean, I work now by myself and I have been doing for the last 20 years now. It's nearly 20 years since I left Sotheby's, which is just extraordinary. But I don't feel I'm working alone because I have my colleagues. Almost, I feel like I just pick up the phone or I WhatsApp them or text them and we speak quickly and... You know, there is still that camaraderie and trust. And I think maybe because, you know, it is so wide, the web and the internet, and it's even more important to have that close connection with someone. I think the trust is even more important. I mean, it's always important. It can't be, you know, trust is trust. But I really value the people that I deal with.
Mm.
Really value them. I value their friendship and I value their trust. And, you know, it's still, you know, if someone steps out of line, well, that's it. You're never back in again. I mean, there's a couple of people I walk across the road and I'll cross over the other side and I will never, you know, entertain them.
Yeah. Well, it still is a small world. So if there's issues with your reputation, news travels fast.
Yeah, it does. It still does. Yes. Yes.
And coming back just to the general public and the need, you're also involved with Gemma and the Goldsmiths Company and whatnot. Education is very important. How educated is the general public? Some of the questions that you get when you do this Antiques Roadshow, are people... Where are they getting their information? Or are you sometimes confronted with people thinking that they've got a $1 million piece and then it's just worth, you know, £5? Or what is the public's perception of jewellery or gemstones?
Well, I think, well, first of all, I think insurance valuations in the past have always been so different to what they could sell a piece for. And so there is always that big discrepancy which needs explaining, and sometimes you can explain it and sometimes you can't explain it because it shouldn't be that wide and that, you know, that different from the sale price to the insurance replacement value. And I think, you know, the marketing is quite powerful, and I am amazed how marketing can stick in a person's mind. And I suppose, you know, diamonds is an example of how, you know, De Beers, you know, diamonds are a girl's best friend and diamonds are forever. And, you know, you spend 2 months' salary on a diamond, or, you know, all of these people can still recite now because of the power of advertising and the power of marketing. And De Beers will always go down in history as the best marketeers, I should think. And, yeah, I mean, you know, we're sitting at the Goldsmiths Hall. It's celebrating its 700th year in 2027. had its charter in 1327.
Wow.
When it hallmarked goods to make sure that gold and silver that was bought and sold within the city walls of London were of a standard that was consistent, to protect the consumer and to protect the buyers and the dealers. And that was first so that you could trade within the city walls of London, and then it expanded, obviously, to Great Britain. And that protection is still there to this day. It is the hallmarking, the assaying your metal is there to protect the consumer. And but for British hallmarks, there is a series of marks, and each one represents, the fineness of the gold or the fineness of the silver, the year that it was hallmarked, which assay office hallmarked it, and the maker's mark of the person who made it or the person who retailed it. So there's quite a story, a significant story in those marks on your piece. And people will still, they don't really understand it. And yet it's been going on for 700 years. And it is your best form of protection for the consumer. And the British Hallmarking Council commissioned a survey, which was done to see how much was sold on the internet that said it was 9 carat or 18 carat, and it wasn't. And it was like 40%. Mm. It's a very, very
And I imagine
high.
That for gems it wouldn't be all too different with treatments and synthetics and imitations and whatnot.
If not more so. So I am amazed that people think 18 CT or 18K stamped on a shank is good enough to say that it is 18 carat gold. It's not.
You need to keep educating and informing.
You need to. So I love being part of educating people from the Goldsmiths Company is a form of education for sure. And, with the Goldsmiths Centre that the Goldsmiths Company supports and set up in 2012, where I think there's about 130 different jewellers and businesses and silversmiths reside there. They've got workshops there. You've got apprentices, you've got bursaries, you've got foundation classes. There are all types of talks going on. It's an amazing hub to support the trade in the industry. So for me, it's just it's wonderful to be involved in that. And also from my own personal perspective, it was through knowledge how I got on. So if I don't have the knowledge, then I wouldn't have been able to have done what I've done. But you learn on the job, you learn on the job.
You learn on the job. So have you ever made any mistakes? I mean, have you valued something, for example, and then it turned out to be much more expensive than afterwards?
I've got a personal indemnity against that.
You're just giving people this information evaluation. I mean, it's purely informational.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
I mean,
yes,
it's just information that I have that, and it's my opinion, it's my opinion sometimes. I mean, not everything's my opinion, obviously. Some things are what they are. But I think you've got to get your hands dirty. When you go to places and see where things are made, that I find fascinating. I love being able to see different trades and to see how they, I haven't cut stones, but I've watched them being cut and, enamelling or all these different trades is so, it's magical to see how these trades and the craft and the skills can come together to create a beautiful piece. We commissioned, with the Goldsmiths Company hat on, we commissioned the coronation cup for King Charles III to have at Mansion House for his first banquet as king. And the coronation cup is an amazing, beautiful object that 11 craftspeople helped to make, and 11 different crafts were involved in this one coronation cup. And I just recently wrote an article for a magazine. It was about the value of craft in the digital era. And I interviewed lots of different craftsmen. And what was really a surprise and wonderful to hear was that they weren't worried about AI because they see it as just another tool. One person said, you know, well, we had drills, we had hand drills, then we had electric drills, then we had laser drills, and then we had CAD. And, you know, but he said these have all been tools. They haven't replaced the craft. They haven't replaced the hand skills that take years and years to learn. So that was great. And I think, yeah, I think the craft and the hand skills hopefully will have a renaissance and or have an appreciation from the consumer, because it's a two-way thing. The consumer, you know, going back to education, you've got to educate the consumer about the complexities and the skills and the soul that has gone into these pieces. You can see a CAD piece because it has no soul. Mm. You know, you can tell if it's been made totally by machine. But as yet, AI cannot put the soul into a piece. And that's what all these craftspeople said. They said, you know, that AI does not have my brain at the moment. So that was very reassuring. Mm. And so the people downstairs that we, you know, that it's week two of Goldsmiths Fair, and to see all the wonderful talent that is there, and to think that you just need to get as many people to see it and to buy it for them to continue.
Mm.
Because we, you know, human beings without creativity, I mean, to me, that's a lost, you know, you end up being a machine. I mean, we are human beings. Human beings are about emotion. It's about creativity. And going back to your first original question, then that's when the stones and the jewellery and all of the human emotion will be played into those stones or all those pieces of jewellery or silver.
Well, I think that's the beauty of jewellery, is that we don't need it, we don't eat it, we don't do anything with it. So this element of craft, will it be a renaissance, or is it already a renaissance, or is it kind of a two-tiered street where you have jewellery which is generically branded and rather low cost, and then you have, not necessarily high-end, but you have things that are really crafted and where people consume less but they consume better. And that's perhaps where I find some optimism with gemstones or pearls or just jewellery that is beautifully crafted, is that if you train the public well enough to really have a trained eye to see what is beautiful or not, or for them to really get a feeling for that, they do seem, you know, open to that.
But that's why the Antiques Roadshow is such a wonderful platform for me to be able to say, look at the back,
yeah,
look at this. I try to educate people on the show,
hmm,
why something has caught my eye. And why is it that, it, you know, that price and the craftsmanship that's gone into either the cutting of the stone or,
yeah,
whatever it is. But yes, that is so important. And to have a platform like that is great. I mean, you know, 6 million people still watch it. And it's been going for like 47 years on the night, you know, on a Sunday night.
Do you often get stopped on the street and people say, here's my ring or here's my necklace?
No, they usually say, weren't we at a party last night? I'm like, oh, no, probably yeah. I was in your lounge at the time, but virtually through the telly.
And you wrote three books, Ruby, Sapphire, Emeralds.
Yes.
So you moved a little bit away from diamonds.
Yes.
Is there one you prefer? Is it hard to choose? Is it like children where you can't say which one's your favourite?
No. Each one was...
Well, not necessarily the book, but the stone. I'm also curious about why certain people prefer certain stones.
Oh, I think that's just a personal intuition, a personal feeling. I don't think you can put that into words, actually. It's beyond words. Out of those three, I've never had much dealings with or feelings with emeralds. They've never really spoken to me. Rubies, that's... Something's happen in your life and you think later on, you think, did that actually happen or have I just made that up? And as you get older, you're thinking, that's why I'm writing everything down, because just to make sure it did happen and I didn't make it up. But I remember I was just had put... So those three books, Emerald, Ruby and Sapphire, took a total of 10 years to write, and, you know, going and visiting a lot of the gem deposits. as well, and it, which was amazing. I mean, that for me, those three books, is rather like the deal with Garrard's. Yeah, it's up there. It's up there as a period of time that I'm proud of. So with Ruby, and I had just finished the book, and I was at home, and this old lady was walking across the front of my house in the front garden, and she was peering through the hedges, and I thought, I wonder what she's doing. So I went out to see her, and she said, you know, I was just wanting to see what these houses were like from the gardens from the back, because you can't see them from the front. So I said, oh, she said, my son is thinking of buying one of these. I went, oh, okay, you know, it's fine, carry on. And I said, well, I'm going to be moving house myself for a while. And I said, well, come in to, you know, I said, I can give you some information about the area. So she came into my office at home, and there was all these kind of pages of Ruby, which was all sort of scattered over my desk. It hadn't quite gone to print, but it was about to go to print, and I had all the proofs all over my desk. And she said, oh, you've written a book, what's all this about Ruby? And I said, oh, I've actually just, you know, put it to bed. It's in the printers, because she asked for a copy. And I said, well, I don't have a copy. And then she, and I feel very weird saying this, but it did happen. And she pulled out of her pocket this biggest ruby and it was sort of like, you know, I'm more like a corundum, you know, rather than a ruby. It was sort of matrix in corundum, red. And she pulled out this ruby and she said, I'm the keeper of the ruby. This is my, I've forgotten the exact word. I wrote it down. And she said, I have been destined to look after rubies or something. Or you know, the elders have given me the responsibility to look after rubies. And I'm just thinking, what?
Wow. What a coincidence.
I went, what? And I said, yes, well, I've written some books. And I've written her name down. And she wrote some books on mysticism, what have you, sort of like paperback type things. And I wrote it down. And then she said, and I said, well, you better. I said, that's from it. That's an old Indian stone. She said, yes, you're right. I said, oh, that's very nice. I said, well, you should, you know, make sure you look after it. She said, oh, yes, I will. She said, I won't lose it. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to be putting a ruby in the four corners of my house, because that's what they do in Mogok, to protect the house. She said, oh, yes, you must do that. I said, no, I will do that, because I'd just come back from Burma. So I had heard of this story of how you protect your house by putting a ruby crystal in the four corners of your house. And then she said, well, I must go now. I said, oh, okay. Off she went with this ruby in her pocket. It was bizarre.
Incredible.
Totally bizarre. And then I just finished Sapphire, and I had a sapphire crystal another time, a few years later, when I finished Sapphire. And I was doing this show and tell at dinner, and I brought this sapphire crystal out and handed it. I said, we've got to be careful with this. And I handed it to somebody, and they put it down next to their crystal glass, and the glass shattered. Just shattered. I said, other people have seen this. You know, just to make sure it wasn't me or I hadn't made it up. So when people say to me, you know, stones and energy and all this, I certainly don't poo-poo it. And I have certainly had more than, you know, those two occasions when things have happened with stones. So I have a lot of respect for stones. And I like that. I like that because we're little humans. I mean, we're, you know, there's a whole other world out there we know nothing about. And I like that. Mm. And I think stones and gemstones is a little tiny window into that other world, which we are not really receptive to.
Mm-hmm.
Or we think we are, or you think something's there, or but you can't explain it. And I quite like the fact that you can't explain it.
Well, and there's still a mystery around gemstones.
Yes.
And it's going to be a different mystery for every single person, but that's what probably keeps us curious as well.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Be it in research or in teaching or in trade or in history or whatever it is. But there's this element of fascination that also comes from mystery, I think.
But and that, you know, what you do at SSEF with all your science and how that's changed and evolved and what you can now tell about gemstones is unbelievable. Just to see that 50 years ago, you know, no one was really understood the difference between a, you know, stone from Sri Lanka or a stone from Kashmir or whatever. I mean, what, they'd get very confused over those two anyway. They wouldn't be able to tell the difference. So, yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. And, you know, I did an article about synthetic diamonds and natural diamonds for the Goldsmiths Review just recently. And, you know, just talking to people about the synthetic diamond from the technology side, oh, my goodness. Do you know, it's fascinating, quantum sensors and all this business. I mean, it's a whole other dimension.
And the future of synthetic diamonds is not jewellery. The future of synthetic diamonds lies elsewhere.
No, definitely.
It was just good press or whatever it was, but it may just be a phase. And it's really interesting. I've been digging a little bit deeper in literature to see how, when cultured pearls first arrived in the market and Verneuil synthetic rubies arrived in the market, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, just the kind of the discourse, the language that was used, how the trade fell. There's so many parallels to what is happening with synthetic diamonds today, even though there was no TikTok, Snapchat, Instagram, whatever back then. It's so interesting when something comes and kind of rattles the trade this way, how emotional people get and the reactions that people have to it.
As a gemologist, jewellery specialist, I am so pleased that I am living in this period, because I feel like I'd missed out on the Verneuil, the synthetics, the cultured pearls, the, you know, all of that. Suddenly we've got this game changer, and to be living through it, having started off the tail end of conventional diamond dealing, and diamonds were king, and, you know, no one questioned it, and no one questioned its, the investment and all this business. Oh, my gosh, to actually see and hear what's going on, I find absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And it's not the end of anything. It's just changing. It's just changing.
And so where do you see it changing to? I mean, perhaps as a final question, I'd like to ask you, why do humans, or why have humans, collected gems and made jewellery for millennia? And where are we going with all this?
Well, I think going back to, you know, my two instances of rubies and sapphires and how gems were, you know, they have an energy. So we are drawn to that, and we always will be drawn to that. And people will say, even if a wedding ring, you know, for some people, they would never take their wedding ring off. You know, they would feel naked. They would feel that they didn't have a partner. They'd feel, and that's just a band of gold. So the connotations associated with just a simple band of gold is enormous. And that's never going to change. Those feelings will still need feeding. Those needs and those emotions will still need to be fed by something. And that something is still going to be something that we can wear, something we can hold, something that's tangible.
And durable.
So whether, you know, gold at the moment, you know, it gets too expensive for people to be able to make as much gold jewellery, but the craft, and you'll see, you know, downstairs, the craft of what they've been able to use with niobium and titanium and all these other aluminium, all these other materials, the craft is still there, and the association with it will still be there. It just, I think the materials will change, and the materials will develop. And the same with stones. You know, I think it's you know, diamonds are now allowing other stones to come into people's minds a bit more, which is, I think, is great, because actually it gives people the opportunity to, you know, it doesn't matter if it's an agate, it doesn't matter what it is, if it's beautiful to you and it's durable, and, you know, that will have meaning and it will have a significance for you and something, you know, everyone loves passing things down to other people. And it's a part of you that's passed down. You know, I wear my mother's jewellery and it reminds me of her. And I do. I literally, sometimes when I go out somewhere, I think, oh, I think I'd like mum to come with me. And literally, it's by putting something on will make me feel that mum is with me. And so that will never, ever change. I mean, one of the people that I interviewed for the digital article, she, which I had never heard, she has a metahuman that wears her jewellery. I said, what is a metahuman? Which is a digital human who wears her jewellery in the space of where metahumans live, which is on the internet somewhere. But she said, well, that's just advertising my jewellery, but I will physically make it. So she said, you know, I still want to physically make it, but I just advertise it on a metahuman. So I just thought, well, there we go. You know, but it's still the same. It's just how things are going to be utilised and marketed and the technology. But the fundamental emotions and feelings, it will still be there. And so jewellery will still be there. And silver surfing will still be there. And gemstones will still be there, which is lovely. And therefore, there will be jobs for people in the future to still educate people, to still want to wear it, to still buy it, to still collect it. So I don't see anything changing. The jobs are still there, and that is great. So it's not a dying profession at all. It's just a changing one. And I'm very pleased to still be part of it and see the change.
Well, so many more years, Joanna.
Yes, definitely.
Thank you so much for this conversation. And I think let's go downstairs to see the fair.
Great. Love to show
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Our guest was Joanna Hardy on curiosity, coloured gemstones, and why trust and craftsmanship still matter. That was another Hidden Gem by SSCF, the Swiss Gemological Institute. Thank you for listening.